Okay, the first presentation today is 100,000 Homes Campaign, Solving the Public Health Crisis of Homelessness, and our presenter is Catherine Craig. Catherine Craig is the Director of Health Integration at Community Solutions and has over 13 years of experience in psychiatric social work, mental health research, and systems improvement. Her expertise includes an ability to communicate with diverse stakeholders to develop systems improvements, facilitate change processes, and distill innovations in ways that enable scale-up of successful initiatives. Catherine works with communities participating in the 100,000 Homes campaign to strengthen partnerships between healthcare and housing providers to improve the health of vulnerable people experiencing homelessness while decreasing unnecessary healthcare costs. She serves as faculty in the Institute for Healthcare Improvement Triple Aim Initiative. Catherine?
Catherine with the 100,000 Homes campaign. And this session is going to be probably on the quicker side, and I think it's going to help to sort of frame the whole conversation this morning. Everybody that you're going to hear speak today is working in a community that's participating in the 100,000 Homes campaign, and I'll define that in just a second once I learn how to, here we go, click. So I think what we'll be able to work out together today is a understanding of how homelessness impacts both people's health and the healthcare system. And I think you'll also get a little taste of some community-based partnerships that can help to improve people's health and the effective use of the healthcare system. And you'll hear a lot of detail about that from our teams today, so I'll just go over that piece a bit quickly. So the 100,000 Homes campaign was an initiative launched two summers ago in 2010, and it's a three-year initiative that aims to end chronic homelessness across the U.S. by July of 2013. And we're doing that by working together, basically connecting up to each other all the different innovators working in communities around the country who are doing amazing work in identifying people experiencing chronic homelessness, helping them to come back inside into housing, and then connecting them up with the services and resources they need to make that a really successful transition. So what we're doing at the campaign is building an infrastructure so that people in Philadelphia can learn from people in Portland, so that we're all working on solving homelessness together, and in doing so, we're going to be able to solve it that much quicker altogether. Right now, there's 101 communities who are participating in the campaign, which is very exciting. If you're from a community that you think might not be on this map, and this isn't the most detailed one we have, but if you look at 100khomes.org, you can find this map and click through and see if your community is involved. If it is, you can find the local contact that you can get in contact with there in your community. And if it's not, we'd love to hear from you to hear about the great work you're doing and connect you up with the others across the country. So I want to just take a minute to share with you probably information that's somewhat familiar to folks in this room, and that's the toll of homelessness on both people's own health who are experiencing the homelessness and also on the healthcare system. So what we're finding, where we're working with communities to go out and meet everybody who's sleeping out in the community, under bridges, on sidewalks, in parks, on beaches, depending on where they are, and with teams of volunteers across the community to canvass those communities and meet everybody who's sleeping outside to learn more about their health and their housing needs. And what we're learning with this database that's growing every day, right now we've got about 23,000 people who have agreed to allow their surveys to be into our database. And from that database, we found that fully 46% of people experiencing chronic homelessness are living with at least one serious health condition. 57% of folks are struggling with a substance abuse need, and 45% are living with a mental health need. What's probably most staggering to folks working in both of these systems, healthcare and homelessness work, is that 22% of people, more than a fifth, are living with each of those things, a mental health, a substance abuse, and a physical health need. So managing all of that while living outside is just, you know, it calls out for a really urgent intervention. And so we're seeing the crisis of chronic homelessness as a real public health crisis. Over on the right-hand part of the screen there, you see a little graph. What we know is across the U.S., across all insurance payment systems, whether it's Medicaid and Medicare or private insurers or entirely uninsured, 3% of the people using the system, so 3% of all of us, drive up 37% of hospital costs. So that means there's a small percentage of people who have so many different illnesses that they're needing to use the hospital-based system quite a bit. What we also know from further research, there's a study done by Dr. Ryan McCormick's colleague Maria Raven in New York, where they found that fully two-thirds of people who were frequently using the hospitals were either homeless or unstably housed. So the overlap here of folks who are really struggling with their health and the healthcare system really struggling to meet people's needs is staggering. So we're sure that we can sort this out together between healthcare, homelessness, outreach teams, and housing folks. To think about it a little bit wider, the impact of continued homelessness on the overall social net is really huge as well. So the cost of booking and rebooking people in city jails, of holding people in prison, of helping people out in shelters, is quite high. All of those costs are higher at an annual rate than the cost of helping someone to live inside in permanent supportive housing where they have their own lease, they have services that they're eligible for using there on site. The highest rates here that you see are the hospital-based costs that we already talked about, but the other costs across the community are high as well. So the campaign communities, the 101 of them so far, have helped back into housing nearly 11,000 people, and our goal is to help 100,000 people into permanent housing within just about a year and 8 months more. So we need to really pick up the pace, we think, but we're working on ways to pick up that pace. Just want to check the time here. Okay, we're doing okay. So we've launched this campaign with a whole network of national partners, and these national partners are really integral in making sure that we can sort of amp up the impact that everybody has in their own local community. So to give you an example, we've been working with the Veterans Administration for years now to try to work out more and more effective partnerships between the VA and folks who are ending homelessness locally. And what we're looking forward to, we had a call this past month where Vince Kane, who heads up the HUD-VASH program, which is the Housing and Urban Development's VA supportive housing program, he was able to share with everybody across the country that the Veterans Administration is very close to announcing a commitment to basically a campaign within the campaign, so that in 2012 we're going to look forward to working very closely with the VA across the country to be able to bring back into housing 12,000 people in the year who are all veterans of our armed services and our experience in homelessness, and are eligible for specific housing vouchers and specific service vouchers that go along with those housing units. So that's a really exciting partnership, and we think that partnership and others like it are going to help the communities who are doing really good work to be able to propel their own work forward at a momentum that might be different if we weren't all pushing our boats forward together in this way through the campaign. So, sorry for the coughing. The model that we share with campaign communities has these different elements to it. We drew it out in a relatively linear way where you start with building a local team as step one. Then you clarify the demand, likely through a registry week event, which we help communities to carry out, which hinges on a particular survey where we are able within less than 10 minutes and using just volunteers to understand people's health and housing needs really quickly, and also to understand what they're most likely to be eligible for in the form of housing and services. So we learn about, in those 10 minutes, both people's chronic health needs, their substance abuse and mental health needs, but also whether or not they're a vet, whether or not they are involved in the foster care system, so whether or not they're over the age of 62, so we can sort out which of the community's housing resources ought to be deployed to meet their needs. We also work with communities in step three to line up the supply of both housing and services that help people to maintain that housing. The next step we see is to help people move into the housing, so matching the supply of housing to the demand of people who need it. And then the fifth step is helping people to stay housed. And we sort of saw it when we started as a linear thing, and we would help people with step one first and then step two. And what we realize now is that we're basically here to help communities to work on whatever part of this is sticky. So some communities are really great at clarifying the demand using a different tool. That's fantastic. If they need support in lining up housing or services supply, we can help them with that through this network of colleagues around the country. So no need to see this as a linear model that we saw it as before. Just to help you understand the public health aspects of chronic homelessness, I want to share with you what the basis of the Vulnerability Index, which is the tool that we offer to share with communities to understand their own housing and health needs among people living outside. That tool we developed with partners in New York City once we learned about Dr. Stephen Huang and Jim O'Connell's research out of Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless, where they looked at a longitudinal study, so over time, to see among the people who are experiencing chronic homelessness there in Boston, what was the difference between the ones who lived during the duration of the project, which was over the course of about 7 years, and were there similarities between those who died during the course of the project? And what they identified was basically 8 different risk factors for early death with continued homelessness. So we're encouraging communities to go ahead and use those risk factors to prioritize people into housing. So if you find someone out on the street who has an experience of frostbite or of HIV and AIDS or of kidney disease or liver disease, who's just over the age of 60, that alone makes people more vulnerable to dying with continued homelessness, or who've used the hospital frequently in the past year. And for those of us working with within healthcare or with street outreach teams, the frequent use is actually defined, I think, pretty lightly. So this is if you've used the emergency room 3 times or more in the last 3 months, or if you've used the inpatient care 3 times or more in a year, even if one of those 3 counts is just going to the emergency room. So it's frequent, but it's not a really high bar for frequent use, which I think is important to point out here. The trimorbidity that we define at the bottom there, that just means people who are living with a physical health need, a substance abuse need, and a mental health need all at the same time. So 22% of the people we find across the country fit in that category. What I did here was try to share with you among the whole group of a little over 23,000 people whose information we have in this database, the frequencies of each of those vulnerability risk factors. And then once you look at the subset of people who qualify as vulnerable to death with continued homelessness, what those risk factors look like among that population. So you see the pinkish bars over on the right, those are the folks who are vulnerable to risk to death with continued homelessness. What really jumps out to me is that the frequent use doubles for those folks, or more than doubles. trimorbidity more than doubles. Being age 60 or over more than doubles. So there's some trends we're seeing among people who are at risk of dying with continued homelessness. So what are communities doing about it? I'm going to just kind of share this with you really briefly because we're really lucky to have 3 different communities represented here who are shared on this little graph today. But basically, there's communities around the country who are trying to work really creatively to figure out how to tie together effectively the intervention of permanent supportive housing with urgent health care that people are going to need to use to be able to make that transition into housing successful. there's also, in each of these programs that you're going to hear about, the element of ongoing preventative health care. So you're going to see how those things all play together between these different presentations. And all the communities are sorting out their own ways of addressing the challenges they're seeing in their communities. And I think the positive part of the campaign, what we're so excited about, is that we're able to bring folks together and make sure we're all learning from each other in real time. So that, you know, Laura, who's sitting here in the purple sweater from Philadelphia, can easily import something that Nick at the end of the table does in Portland pretty much in real time. And we're working with communities to do that. We're offering technical assistance to help folks to improve their services in a stepwise way. We're doing that in a couple different ways, where there's a handful of staff who are staffing the campaign itself, who are here to help people across the country to do this sort of work better. there's also, we just launched this month, an advanced work group for communities who have placed into housing at least 20 different people into permanent housing, and who want to think collaboratively about effective ways of delivering services to make sure that that housing placement sticks and is something that's really positive in every new resident's life, and also to make sure that we're able to address challenges that are common across all of those programs. And I think we're going to be able at the end of this six-month work group to both catalog some very common challenges, but also, more importantly, solutions that people have figured out in their own communities. There's another thing that we're hearing is really challenging across the campaign. Lining up housing supply can be tricky, but we're finding that communities with a little bit of technical assistance are doing that fantastically. But what we're hearing across the board is that funding the services that make the housing successful is a very difficult thing across the country. And so what we'd like to do in the six-month work group is to have basically a library of all the different ways that communities are paying for those services, and then be able to bring policy recommendations to here in DC and be able to say, look, if folks are living in housing and are eligible for Medicaid, or are end up, you know, being seen in the emergency room in the hospital quite a bit, what can we do about making sure that we're able to offer people services that help them to maintain and improve their health, and also help them to use services in a way that is cost effective. So potentially to shift from seeing care in the hospital to having care providers in the community. And we see that across the board as people move into permanent supportive housing, the use of hospital-based care goes down tremendously, and even when you account for the uptick in preventative community-based care, the overall cost savings to the community is about 60% of those healthcare costs are going down once people are living back in permanent housing, which is pretty exciting. So altogether, we're also going to be tracking health improvements, because that's something that I think the policymakers need to see more of. So we're looking at our colleagues around the country to see if we can collect some local data that shows health improvements to be able to push these policy arguments forward even further. There's another thing we're working on, which is a qualitative study of communities that are helping people to achieve a 90% or higher one-year housing retention rate across the board in that community. So we're going to look at those sort of high-performing communities, learn from them what the service mix is that they're offering in their community, how they're funding that, and then be able to share that back with the rest of the campaign so that as communities are putting together their own service packages, they can do it in that way. The next step is what I was just describing, distilling this information out so that we can share it with other communities across the country. We've pulled together 1 to 2 day workshops for other key parts of the campaign. One is a registry week workshop where people use that survey to canvas the community. And another is what we're calling a housing place. We actually call them boot camps. So the housing placement boot camp. What we'd like to be able to create within the next year is a services boot camp, where we're able to share with communities really quickly, here's the key elements of services that help people maintain that housing and make it a really positive thing, and here's your three top ways of funding those. So we're working on trying to pull together all of this amazing work that's happening around the country and distill it down to the bare bones that we can then share out in this replication. So we're happy to take questions after everybody's presented, but it probably works out better to do it that way. And I think it's Laura and her team that are up next, right? Yeah.